Hello, everybody. Welcome to Oncology Decoded, where cancer science meets clarity. I'm your host, Manoj Bhupathi, and with me is Ben Garmazy. We're recording on a Friday again in the summertime. We're here to continue our ASCO discussion. We'll be talking about bladder cancer and kidney cancer. Not as exciting as prostate cancer, given the plenary session. However, there are still some, wouldn't say necessarily practice changing, but practice guiding information that we learned from ASCO 2026. Ben, do you want to kick us off and say a few words before we get started?
Yeah, I mean, we just did the prostate session. So stay, you know, go into the podcast feed, pull that up if you want to hear about Proteus and Calipro 3 and some of the other practice, potentially practice changing, I think practice changing prostate trials that we discussed. But, you know, I agree, there wasn't anything as flashy in kidney and bladder cancer, but I do think the first thing I want to bring up perhaps is, right? And that's the long-term survival data of EV-302. And the reason why I'm going to say it's perhaps flashy, it's confirming with what both of us think, right? I mean, you have some patients that have been on enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab with metastatic bladder cancer that are what in complete radiographic remission, we can call it that. I don't know if we can call it cures yet. Maybe we can, but you have a couple of those patients in your clinic, right? And I have a couple. He's nodding his head yes. If you're not,
I do have a lot. I do have a lot of patients that have been in complete remission, quote unquote. Yes.
Yeah, and I do too. And so we're starting to think, yeah, maybe we're curing these patients. We've never said it out loud, and it's a minority of patients, of course. But then Tom Powell's presented the long term follow up with updated overall survival for patients with metastatic or advanced urothelial carcinoma with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab. So remember, enfortumab vedotin is a Nectin-4 antibody drug conjugate with an MMAE payload, right? And the reason I'm going into those details is I think there's something special about MMAE. You've heard me say that on this podcast before. I think it is synergistic in urothelial cancer and is a more immunogenic toxin. And I think what's happening is we're giving a better immune therapy to these patients when we combine enfortumab vedotin with immunotherapy, right? So we're giving these patients, and the updated at 3.5 years, 44% of patients are still alive if they got enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab versus 24.6. I give those numbers because that is a huge difference, right? We have a tail of the curve that is flattening out that is somewhere going to probably land somewhere between 30 and 40% at 5 years, right? So I'm very excited. I think some of these patients probably are cured. Now, we don't know. Maybe it's only the node positive patients that are more likely to be in a complete remission 2 years from now. We'll say 5 years when we get up, you know, further experience and data. But I do think there's a subset of patients. And in my personal belief, it's not just node positive patients. I think there's patients with lung metastases that I've seen go into complete radiographic remission as well as ctDNA remission. So I think it's exciting. I think it's worth talking about. And I think while, yes, it's not practice changing because it was already practice changing, I think there's going to be a push within the community to say, look, I think we're finally curing some of these patients with metastatic bladder cancer. And I think that is a big headline, perhaps, from this conference as well.
Totally agree with you. I think it's going to be like the when we saw a doublet immunotherapy with Ipi/Nivo when that first came out in clear cell RCC, where you had this durable response for patients that, 8 years later, we still see that they are cancer free. And I think that's what we're going to see in the bladder cancer with EVP as well. But I think the percentage is obviously much higher in the bladder cancer than we saw in kidney cancer. And this durability is what's going to be the big question that's going to be going forward. And how do we increase that percentage from 40% to 60% or 70%? And when you think about the overall response rate for chemotherapy versus EVP, it's drastically different as well, right? You're seeing almost 70% of patients that are responding to EVP with a potentially better tolerability from a toxicity profile standpoint, even compared to chemotherapy. We always used to think, can I give these patients cisplatin or not give them cisplatin? We don't even need to think about that anymore because you can give them EVP and cisplatin is not really even considered a big factor as much anymore.
Yeah, I agree. There's so few patients that I don't give EVP to frontline. It's really these patients with bad autoimmune disease, right? I don't, you know, if we have diabetics or we have patients with high comorbidities that historically wouldn't have been candidates for these clinical trials with enfortumab vedotin, I'm still giving this. I'm titrating insulin sometimes. Who would have thought that an oncologist would have to go back and do that? But you know what? To give this potentially life-changing therapy, I think we all have to be humbled, go back and try to relearn some of the things that we had to learn in internal medicine training in order to increase the funnel of patients that are eligible for this treatment paradigm. And I think, you know, ultimately that's why we probably go through internal medicine so that we can learn to really help manage these side effects in these patients that are more prone to them. But I agree with you. I think overall it's a very well-tolerated regimen relative to chemotherapy and immunotherapy. So I think it's been a huge benefit to patients. And I think we can, you know, put a stamp on it. And I'll say in the future, you know, we do have a press release. Volga's going to give us data. We hope by the end of the year, we'll find out. But that's a trial with enfortumab vedotin, but with durvalumab and tremelimumab. So we will see if that combination looks as good, better, maybe not as good. We'll find out and we'll discuss it at that time. And I think that's where the future is, to see where that is. And then how do we go from there? Another conversation, right? We'll bring that in 2027.
But before we move on, I want to highlight two additional numbers, even though we don't usually do that, right? So when you look at the long-term follow-up, when you look at overall survival and the patients that actually responded in EVP, the overall survival was 83.6%. That's huge. We have not seen that number in bladder cancer for advanced disease. And then those that have actually had a deepened response, meaning that they went from PR to CR, was 82%. So really, the key is to have these patients stay on therapy as managing the side effects, as you were just talking about, right? Because you're really impacting their survival and you're really changing the trajectory of their course from potentially a PR to even a CR. So it's really, really, I mean, in my view, I think that's going to be a key thing that's going to be important for going forward for this group.
Yeah, no, well said. Well said.
So kind of shifting gears a little bit, I think kidney cancer was a little bit more exciting at ASCO 2026. A couple of studies, mostly in adjuvant RCC space. Even though we've talked about adjuvant RCC, this seems to be a space that is shifting rather rapidly. And we'll talk about another recent FDA approval for adjuvant RCC as well at the very end. But first off, study is the ctDNA. We've talked about ctDNA on this podcast before. We've had a guest talk about ctDNA. You use ctDNA, I use ctDNA quite regularly in our practice. And we've talked about how its utility may or may not correlate in GU cancer, specifically in kidney cancer or kidney cancer or prostate cancer, but correlates more in bladder cancer. And Rampart was one of the other studies that we're going to talk about using durvalumab monotherapy. What are your thoughts on the ctDNA, Ben? Well, let's start with that one first.
Yeah, I think the reason we talk about it is because we spent a lot of time, you're right, talking about ctDNA, and in urothelial cancer, it is an amazing tool, right? And we talked about that. And then, you know, you had this presentation by Tony Schwery at ASCO looking at the ctDNA in the adjuvant space on the trial that got pembrolizumab approved, right? So it was the pembro versus placebo, clear cell renal cell carcinoma adjuvant study, a year pembro versus placebo. And the ctDNA shedding was just underwhelming. So, I mean, yes, there's some takeaways that patients who are ctDNA positive are definitely more likely to recur. And it's like a tenfold increase in how likely they are to recur, which is not surprising because when their ctDNA is detected, there's disease that's being detected. The issue is under 10% of patients total on the study were able to detect ctDNA, which means the sensitivity of this study was something like 12%. I mean, it was an abysmal sensitivity, which means that this is not a tool that's ready for prime time. Now, they use the Signatera assay. There's other assays out there. And they did show that if you gave the smaller multiplex panel versus a larger multiplex panel, with the larger panel, you could increase the amount of detection, right? But still, even with that larger panel, it still was pretty underwhelming. We know that kidney cancer doesn't shed a lot of DNA. So what I would say is, yes, if you are positive on your ctDNA, that's a bad sign, right? I don't think we should really be even potentially sending it just because the sensitivity rate is so low. It's giving us perhaps a false sense of security for the patient in front of us if we use that as a clinical decision-making tool. But you're an early adopter, Manoj, so push back. Go ahead, push back.
I was just going to say that. I was like, you know, I think it actually is helpful. And the reason why I think it's helpful is clinically, sometimes it's very difficult to figure out, you know, who's truly a bad actor and who's not a bad actor, right? We have our gestalt, like this is going to be a bad actor, but we don't really have clear guidance in saying that this is truly a bad actor. What this study is telling me is that even though your ctDNA is negative, one, you'll still benefit from adjuvant pembrolizumab. But two, if your ctDNA is positive, yes, you're at a higher chance of relapse, but it also reaffirms that your disease is far more aggressive. And it actually is something that we should watch very closely. For a disease that we don't have any other tool to tell us who's truly much more aggressive than others, the positivity doesn't really tell me that. It actually tells me that this cancer is something more that I need to keep my eyes on a little bit closer, as opposed to a reassurance saying that if it's negative, I'm not going to worry about it so much. The positivity offers me more of a guidance, I think, than just simple negativity. Because the study clearly showed that even if you're negative for ctDNA, pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting clearly shows a benefit. So the negative, I think, and I think that's got to be a clear delineation to explain to patients that if it's negative test, it doesn't help us in any way. It's not helping us figure out or monitoring the cancer. It's basically just saying that you still have a benefit with pembrolizumab. However, if it's a positive test, it helps me figure out that the cancer is actually more aggressive than what we actually think, and more of a reason why you should definitely get pembrolizumab. But going forward, if your ctDNA is changing, we probably need to be more aggressive in how we're treating your cancer. Does that make sense?
It does. I don't think you're convincing me, but it does. And here's why. You're going to have to send, I think it was a 5% rate of detection on the usual Signatera assay. And then on the larger assay, it was like 8%. So you're going to say, we're going to send 20 tests, or maybe it's going to be 18 tests, right? And now we know that we get a lot of, like, you know, too little tumor to quantify, right, when we send ctDNA. So that happens too. But you're going to have to send 15-ish tests. We'll average it out. 15 tests to find a patient that's ctDNA positive. So look, there's nothing wrong with it. You're right. You can use it this way of, I know that the negatives doesn't mean anything, like, good, it's negative, but you may or may not have tumors still in your body. It may or may not be shedding from that residual cancer burden that's, we just haven't been able to detect radiographically. If you're positive, that's certainly, well, yeah, you have enough tumor that's shedding DNA. I don't know if it's more aggressive or less aggressive, which you're using. I'm saying there's probably more burden left behind, or maybe it's closer to a blood vessel or something, right? So I don't think we know enough, because it's just such a small shedding event. But you're going to have to send a lot of tests to find those positive. So I don't have a problem with doing it. I'm just not sure that I personally will, because it's just such a burden of volume of tests to find these patients, when ultimately, because the ctDNA negative rate is so high, probably not going to change what I do, because I'm probably going to be offering these patients adjuvant therapy anyways, because I'm a big believer in adjuvant therapy and kidney cancer. So if it's not going to change what I do, it's just going to make me all nervous and everyone else nervous. But I don't think you're wrong. I just don't know that you're convincing me to change my practice.
Yeah. So I don't know that I would send it on every patient, right? So our stage 3 T3 N0 patient, I don't know that I would send it, right? But if I have a T4 patient that's node positive, younger, has rhabdoid or sarcomatoid features, that's a patient I probably will send it on. And I think the reason is, I don't know if there's any data for this, but we'll talk about our recent FDA approval, right? Because earlier we were talking about, how do we decide if we're going to use pembrolizumab alone, or we're going to use pembrolizumab plus belzutifan? Could this be a potential area where we use, if they're positive for ctDNA, probably higher risk, maybe considered using more aggressive adjuvant therapy? I have no idea. It makes sense in some ways, but we have zero data to support any of it. But that's a thought. But that's I guess the reasoning that I'm thinking about.
All right. So final two comments on this subject, right? And then we'll move on. The first one is, we're going to probably have newer assays that may be better at detection. So I'm not going to say no to ctDNA and kidney cancer forever. I'm just saying, for me, not right now. And I'm not using it in metastatic disease in the majority of patients either, for the exact same reason. I just don't know what it means when things go up and down in kidney cancer like I do in urothelial cancer, because of the shedding aspect of the tumor is different. And then the second thing is, you're like my son. You got to go to the end of the book before we're there, right? We're talking about potential new FDA approval. You just gave away the ending here, but we'll get to that. Okay. So anyways, let's move on to adjuvant kidney cancer again, but with an interventional study, right? So this is the DUP study Rampart that was conducted fully in Europe. It looked at high-risk patients after nephrectomy. They use the Leibovitz score. We're not going to talk about the Leibovitz score. No one uses that here, really. But it's just another one of those, like, nomograms to talk about out what your risk is. It's fairly different than the ones that we typically use. But when you do that, and you take this and you offer three arms, placebo, right? Durvalumab, PD-L1 inhibitor, durvalumab, tremelimumab. And we knew from a CTLA-4 inhibitor, we knew from ESMO that the durva-tremi versus placebo arm was positive, right? We saw that data. We discussed that data. Go back into your podcast feed, pull up that ESMO episode, right? But now we're seeing the single arm data as well from the durvalumab versus placebo. And while there is a trend towards a DFS benefit, disease-free survival benefit, it is not statistically significant, which is another negative study. We have negative Nevo for 6 months, negative Nevo Ipi for 6 months. We have negative Durva for a year. We have negative Atezo for a year. We have a negative perioperative study with PD-1 inhibition as well. And now we do have the positive adjuvant pembrolizumab, right? Which we use, a lot of us use. I think the majority of people I talk to use that data. And now we have positive Durva Tremi, right? Now, there's some nice things about this trial, right? 15% non-clear cell. So we have some data there, though we haven't seen specifically that cohort, how it reacts to the immune therapy. But now we have negative Durva, right? So it's just another kind of weight on the scales of perioperative immunotherapy not coming across the finish line, except for pembrolizumab. Now, again, I'm not that surprised. I've talked on this podcast, and you've talked on this podcast, that PD-L1 inhibition in kidney cancer is probably not as effective as PD-1 inhibition. So Durva and Atezo, we can explain away. And then maybe the Nevo and the Nevo Ipi trials 6 months wasn't enough, which is why I get nervous when we start pulling off immune therapy based off of maybe ctDNA analysis or maybe radiographic remission. I do think these patients need a year of immune therapy, and I think anything less than that is potentially problematic. And I wonder, maybe a year, who knows if we needed to do more extended interval, right? I just don't think we know how long people really should get immune therapy. But I think that's the study. I think it's important because it sets the stage of, you know, again, PD-L1 inhibitors not crossing the finish line, but at least there was some positivity with the Durva-Tremi. Now, what to make of that? Will this, in my opinion, move forward anyway in the United States? I doubt it, right? It wasn't actually designed to be a regulatory approved study here in America, so I don't think we'll probably be using it. But what was your takeaway, Manoj? Did you take anything positive from the presentation?
No, I think it's just basically everything you said. I agree. I just don't know. I don't know that this is going to be an uptake in the United States. And I just don't know that, actually, not even in the United States, just globally, I don't know that we're going to use Durva-Tremi in the adjuvant space, right? It was interesting to see that there are non-clear cell patients included, about 15% across the board. We've not seen that before. And, you know, those are higher risk patients in some degrees, but again, we don't have any strong evidence to say that that group will truly benefit from Durva-Tremi, certainly do not benefit from Durva. And so, you know, it really reaffirms that at least for me, in the non-clear cell for right now, still active monitoring is probably just as good as doing any sort of immunotherapy, whether it be, whether you're looking at Durva or Durva-Tremi combination. So I completely agree. I think it's really just coming down to pembrolizumab as your adjuvant therapy. Since I already opened the, I already went to the end of the book per your analogy. So I'll let you.
Let's go to the end. I think we're there. So FDA approval, right? So this wasn't presented. This is an ASCO, right? This was data that was presented. What, GU ASCO, right?
GU ASCO.
So, but I guess only 4 months ago. Where the trial was adjuvant pembrolizumab for a year versus adjuvant pembrolizumab and belzutifan for a year. Remember, belzutifan, oral HIF inhibitor, causes fatigue and hypoxia. It's not like a VEGF TKI, and anemia. Anemia is a big one. And they did this study, and I think there were a little bit of criticisms that there wasn't a placebo-controlled arm here because the control arm is adjuvant pembrolizumab, which has an FDA approval and has an OS benefit. And I think, some of the criticism was, well, you've had a lot of negative immunotherapy studies, and maybe if you ran that KEYNOTE-564 study again, it would be negative and therefore isn't the appropriate control arm. Now, that's not me. That's not you. I like this control arm. I think for some reason, adjuvant pembrolizumab, I do think it's a beneficial treatment in this patient population. I don't want to relitigate that, but I do think there was some rumblings about that at ASCO in the hallways and at the microphones. But I will say this study came home with a DFS benefit, right? Nearly hazard ratio around 0.7-ish. And then the overall survival was trending in the right direction. Now, we don't have mature overall survival data yet. The FDA did not wait for the mature OS signal. and they went ahead and approved it based on the DFS signal. So now we're talking about another positive perioperative study, though it's fully adjuvant, and an FDA approval. And the two of us have debated on this, and a lot of doctors in the community are concerned about overtreatment and toxicity from belzutifan. There's high rates of needing transfusions. And the question is, should we be doing this without an overall survival benefit? Because we could always salvage people with HIF inhibition and VEGF inhibition upon progression if they did develop metastatic disease. And we're going to treat many, many patients with belzutifan that are already cured. And belzutifan is more toxic than single agent pembrolizumab. So I think all these concerns and criticisms are valid. But I am ultimately overall excited to see this FDA approval, because the DFS benefit is pretty strong against an active control arm with an OS benefit.
Yeah, I echo the same thoughts. I do worry that the toxicity there is potential overtreatment, but the control arm is very active. You and I are both already using that. There's many in the community that are using it, and now you have a regimen that's doing better than your control arm. Now, should every patient get this? Probably not. So I'll go back to what I was saying earlier in the podcast, right? So when we're talking about ctDNA and how do we use it and what does that look like? While ctDNA doesn't really help me understand who should get adjuvant therapy, it helps me figure out who's at even higher risk for relapse. So yes, I may have to send more tests, or at least send it in the patients that I truly believe are very high risk, like a very large tumor, renal vein invasion, or, you know, node positive, or had an oligomet that was resected or even radiated. Those patients are truly high risk. Right. So instead of waiting until they develop true metastatic disease, if I have an option that's better than pembrolizumab, why should I not use it if I know that the toxicity can be manageable, or at least drop the bell when it's available, especially if it's a younger patient that's otherwise healthy and fit? I don't know. I don't know the answer to this question. I'm just posing it to you to get your thoughts on it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And I think you know where I'm going with this. Look, there's going to be a few patients that I give adjuvant pembrolizumab alone to, right? And the reason for that is the toxicity burden of belzutifan, right? But still wanting to do something. I don't think ctDNA is necessarily the answer to select who should get belzutifan. There's other ways to say who's high risk, right? You can have T3, T4, sarcomatoid, rhabdoid. And the most interesting thing about that data set, and we talked about this after GU ASCO, was it wasn't the magnitude of benefit is not higher in the higher risk patients. It's not necessarily lower, but it's not higher. And the reason for that is the way belzutifan works, it may work better in lower intermediate risk patients because it's a HIF inhibitor and works better in more angiogenic driven tumors relative to the more nasty sarcomatoid rhabdoid patients that may not get quite as much benefit. Now, I'm not saying we should be thinking at that depth of biological rationality with our adjuvant patients, because I don't think we know. These are hypotheses of why. So I don't think personally I'm going to go into who's the highest risk and who's the lowest risk. If I'm going to offer adjuvant therapy, then I'm going to say, let's do both for the majority of patients. If I'm not going to, and you know, of course, there's patients I don't want to give belzutifan to, and I won't give it, right? But I still think there's a subset of patients I'm not going to offer anything. I'm not going to use the middle ground of pembro alone. I'm like, you guys and gals over here, we're going to surveil you because you have relatively mild T3A disease, and I'm not overly concerned. And then I'm going to have everyone else, if you're fit, the majority of you are going to get the combination. And the reason for that is combination is better than the monotherapy, at least until we see the OS, and the OS changes my mind if it is negative, right? And I reserve the right to change my mind if the OS is negative, and I might change my mind if the OS is negative. That being said, we have to work in clinic now with the data we have on hand, because there's a risk of over and under treatment while we wait for that data to finalize. And I am on the mindset of this hazard ratio looks pretty good. OS is trending in the right direction. I got a patient in front of me. I'm going to offer them therapy for a year to prevent their cancer coming back. Might as well offer them the combination. That's my philosophy. I don't know if it'll be correct. We'll find out in about, I don't know, 2 years. But, you know, it's going to take some time, but we'll find out.
Yeah, I agree that I'm probably going to offer pembrolizumab plus belzutifan to the majority of the patients, but I think there will be certainly be a number of patients that will only get pembrolizumab monotherapy. And again, I think it also depends on who's seeing these patients. Is it going to be our urologic colleagues? Is it going to be our med-onc colleagues? who's going to be seeing this patient, how comfortable they are with managing the toxicity. I think ultimately that's what it's going to come down to, is from a judgment call. I was just really asking or provoking your thoughts on the ctDNA aspect of it, just understanding where it goes. I'm clearly not convinced you, and that's okay. It just means that we need a better MRD testing for kidney cancer. And, you know, that goes to what we looked at earlier, right? We thought PD-L1 was the answer a long time ago, and that was not the answer in kidney cancer either. So any of these markers that we're looking at has not panned out is basically what's happening in RCC. So I think the more we just have to find something else. So that's really where we are at. I think that was all we had for ASCO GU and the recent approval, or I'm sorry, ASCO 2026, not ASCO GU, but we combined ASCO GU into this. And then the recent approval from the FDA for the adjuvant pembrolizumab, or adjuvant RCC with pembrolizumab and belzutifan. With that, thank you so much for listening to us, and follow us on X at Oncology Decoded, as well as email the podcast at oncologydecoded.com. Ben, any final thoughts?
Nope, you just signed off beautifully. See everyone in a little bit in the podcast feed.